I guess this, if it was on reincarnation or anything, this, you know.
Oh, then Daisha.
The Hindu Doctrine of Karma and Reincarnation by Professor M. K. Venkatarama Iyer. This is a characteristic Hindu doctrine. You know, they used to believe in Christianity during Christ's time. Mm. And there was a baby who was blind.
What?
Blind.
Oh.
When they asked Christ, why is that child blind? Is that baby blind? Is it something that the child did? Mm-hmm. That caused the blindness? Or something that the parents did? Mm. You know, like the child could have done nothing, it was just mm-hmm. a baby, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unless...
Yeah.
They're thinking about reincarnation.
What was this answer?
I can't remember.
That was supposed to be a punchline.
This is the characteristic Hindu doctrine, reincarnation and karma. All schools of Indian philosophy, with the sole exception of the Charvaka, have admitted it. A remarkable point is that even Buddhism accepts it, though it does not believe in a permanent entity which could migrate from one bodily existence to another. Footnote. However, the permanent entity envisaged by Hinduism is only permanent and an entity within the domain of Maya, which is itself impermanent and unreal. So, that the difference between the two doctrines turns out to be rather one of expression than fact. That was Arthur Osborne, the editor.
No.
Throws in his footnotes in everybody's article. Okay, you see the glasses. The epics and the Puranas reinforce the doctrine and bring it home to the mind of the generality by means of attractive stories which combine the artful narration of events with unobtrusive moral instruction that man has to pay for his misdeed in the shape of sorrow and suffering, that no one who indulges in wrongdoing can hope to escape its evil consequences, that punishment will overtake the sinner, if not here and now, at least at some future time, that we are the architects of our own destiny, that we have to thank only ourselves if we find ourselves on the bed of thorns, and that wisdom consists in putting the best face on our troubles. These ideas have been so repeatedly born in our mind that they have become part of our very being. They are handed down from generation to generation as part of our national heritage. It never occurs even to unlettered persons to shift the blame for their tribulations on to other shoulders. Well, that's not quite true. These ideas have been so repeatedly borne out. Okay, other shoulders. I gotta get these other glasses, I think. Mm. That their lot in life is the outcome of their own deeds, and a part in past births lies most effortlessly on their lips. The fact that the people of this vast land are, by and large, so law-abiding and peaceful despite their poverty and a thousand other ills, is to be attributed not a little to the continuous propagation of this doctrine. It is a doctrine fully supported by the revealed text, the Shruti, reasoning, Yukti, and the experience of seers, Anubhava. Several passages in the Upanishads, especially the Chandogya and the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, bear on it, quote, "He who entertains desires and prizes them is reborn in a place and environment best suited to their attainment." That's from the Mandukya. The self is identified with desire. What is desirous, it resolves upon. What it resolves upon, it performs. And what it performs, it attains to. Through attachment, it attains the result of its performance in a future birth. That's from the Chandogya Upanishad. The essence of man is his volition. As he wills in this world, so does he become on departing from here. That's all from the Chandogya. So she's quoting all these.
What did he say from the Mandukya? I was walking, I didn't hear the part that he said about the Mandukya.
Well, he said the reborn, he who entertains desires and prizes them is reborn in a place and an environment best suited to their attainment. A man behaves and acts, so does he become. By doing good, he becomes good. By doing evil, he becomes evil. These are all from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and Chandogya and Mandukya. Those who have been of good conduct here will quickly attain a good birth. That of a Brahmin, or a Kshatriya, or a Vaishya. You know, most in the Paripuranams, most of the saints, most of them are Shudras. That they describe. There's some Brahmins there, of course, you know, like Yan Sambandar and Sundar, but most of them. But those who have been of evil conduct will attain an evil birth, that of a dog or a pig, or a Chandala. That's the lower caste, right? Chandala?
Chandala.
I think that's the lower, right? Chandala.
Do you know Chandala?
Chandala, they say, like person who.
Ghost.
In the cremation ground?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lower, very low caste.
Yeah.
Right.
They used to say it's a very, like, very high Brahmin caste, but I don't know.
Fallen.
Yeah. Oh, people fallen. Stay away from them.
Yeah.
But although they are high Brahmin
caste. They're like untouchables.
Yeah.
When the soul departs from the body, it is accompanied by its knowledge, work, and past experiences. That's the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Impressions are left on it by the actions performed by a man throughout his lifetime. Every action leaves its impress not only on the nervous system, but also on the soul. The oftener we perform an action, the stronger and more well-defined the impress becomes until, in the end, it becomes a tendency, a samskara. On the influence of these acquired samskaras, men feel themselves impelled, as by an outer force, towards certain courses of action. We may even feel hopeless against them. And if unfortunately they are of the wrong kind, we indulge in wrongdoing almost against our better judgment. Arjuna gives expression to this feeling when he says, "What impels a man to commit sin? O Krishna, in spite of himself, driven as it were by some force," unquote. And the Lord himself admits that all beings follow their nature, prakriti. What can repression do, unquote. It will be remembered that when Ravana's grandfather advised him to retrace his steps and restore Sita to her Lord, the latter replied that he would rather break in two than bend before anybody. And was his nature and no one could overcome his nature. Evildoers often take cover under this excuse. I am what I am. I can't change. That's why I did it. There used to be a comedian long ago from African America. He used to have a funny line. He said, "The devil in me made me do it." I had nothing to do with it. If a man's tendencies are, fortunately, of the right kind, they lead to good actions which are beneficial to him and others. Such people go on doing good without even being conscious of it. It comes as natural to them as breathing. They expect nothing in return. The samskaras which they have inherited from their own past make it easy for them to lead a life of service. Hereditary and environment may have something to do with it, but the most important factor is his own samskaras. In spite of noble parentage and helpful surroundings, many sons do not live up to expectations. While the contrary is also true, that a profound philosopher or inspired poet emerges from an unpromising environment. It is also a familiar sight to see one son achieve world fame while others born of the same parents remain obscure. These may look like vagaries, but are not really so. Over the above hereditary and environment, there is the legacy of the past, which the individual carries with him in his transmigratory experience. To clinch the point, we may refer to the phenomena of precocity. We sometimes come across boy or prodigies who take to some, when they say boy prodigy, why not girl?
In every text, no?
They say boy prodigy.
They say boy man.
Some special study, such as mathematics or music, like they take to it like a fish in water, and make rapid progress with little effort. The way they go about it looks more like picking up old thread than learning something new. Quote, by his former habit, he is led on in spite of himself, unquote, says the Lord. If we can argue from effects to causes, we are compelled to believe that these exceptional men of genius bring a rich heritage with them when they enter into the conditions of another bodily existence. That's the only way to explain it, other than what the Christians said, they have a gift from God. Mm-hmm. They came and God gave them the gift.
Oh, you know, that's not,
that's not nothing to do with karma. Mm-hmm. Gift. What it comes to, then, is that the soul which arises in a new body does so, as the English poet says, not in entire forgetfulness, not in utter nakedness, but carrying with it its own accumulated tendencies. These do not actually inherit in the soul, for, according to Hindu teaching, this is untouched by good or evil. It is pure consciousness which stands apart and simply witnesses the vicissitudes through which the individual being, the jiva, passes. If the tendencies do not inherit in the soul, they must inherit in something else. For without a substrate or vehicle, they could not pass from the bodily existence to another, from one bodily existence to another. Since the gross physical body is burned to ashes after death, or is buried and decays, we are driven to the conclusion that there must be some other vehicle. This is said to be the subtle body composed of the finer essence of the five elements. And the Taittiriya Upanishad speaks of the soul as being encased within five sheaths, one within another, like the skin of an onion. These are known as koshas. The uttermost is known as the sheath of matter, anamaya koshas. This is identified with the physical body, stula sharira. The next three, known as Pranamaya, Manomaya, and Vijnanamaya koshas, comprise the subtle body, Sukshma, or Linga Sharira. When the soul, due to primeval ignorance, identifies itself with this subtle body, it is known as the individual being, Jiva. It is this Jiva which transmigrates from one bodily existence to another, carrying with it all its acquired good and evil tendencies. On leaving the body, the Jiva, without loss of time, enters another, kept ready for it, and quite suited to the working out of the karma which has come to fruition. Quote, just as when a king is touring the country, the people of the village which he is expected to visit wait for him with various kinds of food and drink and the dwelling place, so is a suitable body and fit environment kept ready for the jiva. Unquote. That's in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. He enters this immediately after putting off the previous body. Quote, just as a caterpillar on the stem of grass goes to the end of it and then takes hold of another support and draws itself toward forward onto it, so does the self throw aside this body, take hold of another support, and draw itself to it. Unquote. Commenting on this passage, Sri Shankara makes the point quite clear. The impression called past experiences stretch out like a caterpillar from the body while retaining their seat in the heart and build another body in accordance with past actions. And when the new body is ready, they let go their grip on the old. It's like we're preparing our next body even now. Yeah. Then when that's all ready, then we just get done with this one. Right? Your new house has been built. You can leave now. Right? In the physical realm, no disturbance can take place without corresponding repercussion. This is what we mean by saying that every cause has its effect. Sometimes the effect may occur almost immediately, and in other cases, in the more or less distant future. Bhagavan said the effect will come sooner in relation to the intensity of the action. Mm-hmm. You know, if you do a one-pointed and very intense action, the result comes sooner mm-hmm. than if you just do it in a casual way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You achieve more.
What?
You achieve more with the intensity.
Well, the result comes sooner. Or in relation to the intensity. This is what we mean by saying that every cause has its effect. Sometimes the effect may occur almost immediately, and in other cases, in the more or less distant future. That every event has its cause, and that nothing can occur without a proper and sufficient cause, are converse statements of the same law. Karma and reincarnation are an exact counterpart of the law of causation, which holds on the physical plane. No man can do wrong and expect to get away with it. That's why they tell us in school, you know, when you go to Christian school, Catholic school, that God is always watching. You know, there's no hiding place down there. They had that song, you know, I went to the rock to hide my face. And the rock called back, there's no hiding place. Punishment will surely overtake him sooner or later. If not in this lifetime, then in another. You know, they really put that into you, the skulls.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-mm. Yeah. Yes, always.
This is, you know, the, body's watching. That's the law of karma, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not actually saying it. It's karma, yeah. But actually that's what it is. You do something, you know, something you're going to get punished for it.
Yeah.
Just as corn takes time to ripen for harvest, so wrong actions take their time to recoil at the door. Reincarnation is therefore the logical complement of the law of karma. The wrongdoer may escape the policeman, but cannot escape the life to come. When the punishment in the shape of suffering and sorrow overtakes a man, wisdom lies in seeing the hidden hand of justice in it. There is no ground for complaint. We lie in the beds we have made for ourselves. My mother used to say, you made the bed, sleep in it. We have therefore to endure our tribulations cheerfully and learn a lesson from them. In the same way also, the good deeds we do take time to produce the result, and we should not be greedy for quick returns. If an upright man is not immediately rewarded, or a wrongdoer enjoys a gay and prosperous life, we need not feel frustrated or lose faith in dharma. The present misfortune of the former and prosperity of the latter have both to be traced to antecedent causes. They must be attributed to the karma built up in the previous life. Well, what is done in the present lifetime will bear fruit in the future life. We have to take a long-range view, and faith in the law of causation compels us to posit a past as well as a future for man. Belief in past and future births is therefore a logical necessity. Countless are the births we have already passed through, although we do not remember them. The physical brain, which is the seat of memory, is destroyed at death, and this accounts for the inability. There are some, however, who are able to recall their past births. The Upanishad mentions the instance of Vamadeva. In the Gita, the Lord says that he remembers his past birth, although ordinary people are not able to. We know in a general way that we have gone through previous periods of probation, though not in detail. The difference that we see between men and their intellectual and other attainments cannot be explained otherwise than by the samskaras which they derived from their past lives. How many lives still await us, we have no way of knowing. It depends on the amount of karma that has yet to be worked out. However, this amount is not fixed quantity, but is constantly being exhausted from one side and added to from the other. Apart from the stock already accumulated, sanchitta karma, there is that which is now being made, agami karma. So that by selfish activity we are creating new burdens for ourselves. In this way, when the karma to be worked off in this lifetime, parabdha karma, is exhausted, its place is taken by another that has been accumulated. And so it goes on. It looks like a self-perpetuating, never-ending affair. Caught in its vortex, it looks as though we should be going round and round in an unending circle. Hindu writers generally compare the jiva's transmigratory career to the limitless ocean, the ocean of samsara. However, it can be both mitigated and brought to an end. The way of mitigating it is by regarding it as opportunities for self-purification and for getting rid of the ingrained vices. These are deep-rooted and die hard. Long and continued discipline is necessary to eradicate them. The Lord says in the Gita, if a yogi strives with diligence, he is cleansed of all his sins, and becoming perfect through many births, he reaches the supreme state. In another context, he says, at the end of many births, the man who knows seeks refuge in me. realizing that Vasudeva is all. Repeated births are not therefore to be regarded only as a punishment, but also as an opportunity for spiritual advancement. The process of return can be accelerated by right knowledge of the self. Such knowledge can bring the transmigratory career of the jiva, that is, the ocean of samsara, to an end at one stroke. We emerge from the endless cycle of samsara the moment we realize that the true self of us has nothing to do with the causal body, the karana sharira, subtle body, sukshma sharira, and physical body, stula sharira, that are caught in it. The pure self has to be disengaged from its adventitious encumbrances. This can be effected at any moment. It lies with us. Only we must put in the required effort. Thus, strange as it may seem, the Hindu doctrine of karma and reincarnation fills us with hope and resignation at the same time. With regard to the past, what we have done is done and irrevocable. We must pay the penalty and accept the punishment in a spirit of resignation. But determination ends here. So far as our future is concerned, it is entirely in our hands. We can make or mar it, and there is no compelling reason why we should do the latter. It is a superficial view to suppose that we are the slaves of our past and that there is no getting out of it. The Lord says in the Gita that the samskaras come into play only if the buddhi, manas, and indriyas, intellect, reason, and senses cooperate with them. If the indriyas are allowed free rein, they run after objects. The samskaras feed on objects through the instrumentality of the intermediate links. Buddhi, manas, and the indriyas belong to the jiva, the lower or individual self, but man has a higher self. And if he reminds himself of this, he can control the lower self. If the sense organs are restrained, the samskaras will have nothing to feed on and will consequently become ineffective. A man will then be free, a free agent, to shape his future. Bhagavan's teaching on Aham Vritti by M.R. Radhagopalacharya. The essence of Sri Bhagavan's teaching, in the practical sense of what an aspirant need know, is earnest and one-pointed inquiry into the source of Aham Vritti. If the mind is turned inward to this inquiry, the vasanas or latent tendencies become extinct. And in the absence of reflection, the reflecting medium, that is, the mind, also disappears, being absorbed into the light of the one reality. Self-inquiry really means intense inward turning of the mind. What it finally leads to in its quest of the source of Aham Vritti is the heart itself, which is the undifferentiated light of pure consciousness, into which the reflected light of the mind is completely absorbed. The Jnani's Lakshya is the heart, which is the self, because he is identical with that undifferentiated pure consciousness referred to in the Upanishad as Prajna, which is actually Brahman, the Absolute. There is no Brahman other than Prajna. Editor's note. Aham Vritti can best be described as a current or vibration of awareness of being. It is centered in the heart at the right side, but may pervade the whole body. Here are the questions of Nachiketas by Madguni Sambhupada. The Katha Upanishad, one of the most important of the 108 greater Upanishads, deals with the true nature of man and with what happens to him after death. It is woven around, or rather grows out, of the story of Nachiketas. Have you read that? Nachiketas story? They compare Bhagavan to him. He was just a boy.
Saints who saw Yama when he was living.
He was a boy. Mm-hmm. His father did. He was doing a special puja, where he offers everything of value in his family, cows, everything. But the son came up. You are offering all this stuff, and not even. But I'm your dearest thing. Why don't you offer me? Mm. And father said, leave me alone, I'm doing it. And he kept pestering him. He said, you should do it fully and do it correctly, the boy said. And then he got annoyed. Okay, you go to hell.
I'll give you to Yama.
You go to Yama. You die. Get out of here. Oh. And so he did, and he went before Yama. That's the story. Because the father was a Brahmin.
Yeah, father, he gave offering cows and all that were very old.
Yeah, not even proper.
Yeah, so the boy felt that what he was doing is not right.
Yeah. Yeah. So he sent in some Brahmin or something, gave a curse to his son and had it be fulfilled.
Who will you give me to? So he says, I'll give you to Yama.
Did Yama send him back?
Yama answered all his questions.
Yeah, so maybe it's here. Let's read it. The Katha Upanishad, one of the most important of the 108 greater Upanishads, deals with the true nature of man and with what happens to him after death. It is woven around, or rather grows out of the story of Nachiketas. His father, a Brahmin, performed sacrifice which involved giving away all his possessions. Nachiketas made a nuisance of himself, criticizing the poor quality of the cattle given away, and then said, a son too is property, so who are you going to give me to? Exasperated, the father replied, oh, I'll give you to Yama. Yama is the god of death. Nachiketas, taking his father's at his word, went to Yama. Yama was away on his errand when the boy arrived, and it was 3 days before he returned. So the boy had to wait 3 days for him. During these 3 days, he fasted. And when Yama did get back, he offered Nachiketas 3 bones to atone for this discourtesy. For the first, Nachiketas asked that his father's anger might cool down, and any anxiety he felt at his son's absence be appeased. For the second, he asked to be instructed in the mysteries of the fire sacrifice. Mm. And for the third, he asked Yama to teach him what happens after death. Who should know it if not Yama? Yama first tried to avoid answering this last question, offering the boy instead all manner of prosperity and a long and successful life. Mm-hmm. But Nachiketas was firm. Finally, the answer was given. Yama mentioned 2 possibilities, rebirth and release. If the buddhi is yoked to a distracted mind, it loses discrimination and remains ever impure. Then the incarnate soul fails to attain its goal, but enters the ground of rebirth. But if the buddhi is yoked to the restrained mind, it possesses discrimination, and then the incarnate soul attains that state from which there is no rebirth. Later he mentions still a 3rd possibility, this time lower than rebirth. Some souls enter a womb for rebirth, and some enter into stationary objects according to their works and knowledge. It is possible to fall below rebirth as well as to rise above it. They're still going in this reincarnation theme here. Here's a quote from the Ashtavakra Gita. Give up rebirth. Kingdoms, sons, wives, bodies, and pleasures have been lost to you birth after birth, in spite of your attachment. Have done then with prosperity, desire, and good works. The mind found no peace in them, in the dreary forest of the world. For how many births have you not done hard and painful work with your body, mind, and speech? Therefore, now at least, desist. This is Sri Ramana Maharshi in the Indian philosophical tradition by His Highness Sri Jaya Samaraja Wadiyar Bahadur. Maharaja Mysore. He had gone to Bahadur. You know, they're all very learned, these Mysore Maharajas.
See, only three people saw Yama while they were living. One is Yudhishthira, one is Nachiketa, and the third one is Savitri. Satyavansa.
Savitri.
Yeah.
So, let me just read what he says in conclusion.
Yeah.
In conclusion, readers of the mountain path, with its non-rivalistic emphasis on sustaining the same wisdom as manifested in the Maharshi, may be interested in the following stanzas which Narayana Guru, this is the Kerala saint. You know, when he visited Bhagavan, and he sent Kunjaswami, was sent to, when he was dying, Kunjaswami was sent for Bhagavan to visit him. He's from Kerala. He wrote stanzas on Bhagavan also. When Narayana Guru composed on a visit to Bhagavan Sri Ramana, 1916, which obviously had the Maharshi in mind. It is called the Manicharya Panchakam. These are the five stanzas. The Way of the Recluse. He composed them in Sanskrit, though. For the hermit whose attachments are gone, his arm makes it not for him a pillow, the earth wherefrom his footsteps fall, gaining sin-dispelling power, makes it not for him a couch. For such as he, what use of good fear? Ever immersed as his mind is in the verity of that thou art, his bliss transcends inclusively all forms of joy. 2. Desireless as he is, for nothing ever asking, partaking of food brought to him by chance, the body just to sustain, from all cares free, sleeping on the thoroughfare, ever immersed in the vision of the self, the hermit attaining to the unity of life and self supreme. He comes to his own state, radiant, everlasting, of being, knowledge, joy. 3. In discourse, the recluse excels, but often restrained in words, he is seen here as one ignorant, wandering, sitting, or standing still. Having once come to this changing body, sanctioned by time, he ever contemplates the state of selfhood's uncut consciousness supreme. And 4. Outside the scope of what is spoken of as existing and non-existing, as unthinkable, ungraspable, minute, not short, stainless, or supreme, immobile, erect, or most exalted, he seeks to attain that all-fourth Turiya state, turning away from both this and that, as one who aims properly to reach beyond both being and non-being. And 5. Let him live in his own home or in the forest, or at the water's edge, no matter, with mind ever fixed in the absolute, the yogi ever dwells, seeing all here in terms of selfhood, like a mirage in a desert land. He enjoyed bliss, that silent one, contemplating that absolute supreme which is beyond all compare.
So Bhagavan was thought to be the reincarnation of
people compared him with him, yeah. But he also faced death. When he lay down in his bed, okay, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. Who is it that dies? And he held his breath, so he's ready to die, to find out the truth of himself. So.